From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
There's the so-called language of flowers, as in the symbolism or sentiment attributed to a rose versus a pansy or a daisy. And then there's the actual language of flowers in botany, as in what's a sepal or a tepal and a bract, or what's a perfect flower, technically speaking. Those are some of the many eclectic lessons, both scientific, historical, and just plain fascinating, I took away from the new little book with a big name, Florapedia, by Carol Gracie. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
Carol Gracie is the author of Florapedia, which calls itself A Brief Compendium of Floral Lore. She's a naturalist and photographer and popular lecturer who has written several previous books on wildflowers, including Spring Wildflowers of the Northeast and Summer Wildflowers of the Northeast, two of my favorites in my cupboard here. And welcome back to the show, Carol. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Yes. So I think this new little book, Florapedia, is part of a series from Princeton University Press. I believe there was a Fungipedia first, if I recall correctly.
Right. That came out last year, and probably in June there'll be Birdpedia, followed by Treepedia, followed by Dinopedia. So they intend to make a whole series of books based on natural history.
It's fun. They're little books. They're kind of a great little gifty kind of thing. And I should say we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of this conversation over on awaytogarden.com. So the book is an A to Z of short entries, all kinds of topics. And, you know, if we're talking flowers and the vocabulary attached to them, maybe we should just start with the word inflorescence. What is an inflorescence?
Well, an inflorescence is usually thought of by most people as a flower. They will look at, for instance, a daisy and say, oh, look at the daisy flower. But in fact, a daisy is comprised of many, many flowers, as are most members of that family, the Asteraceae or the daisy family. They'll do the same thing with skunk cabbage. They'll say, oh, the flowers of skunk cabbage are up. But in fact, skunk cabbage is an inflorescence that is made up of a modified leaf that sort of encloses a little ball-like spadix, it's called, on which are the true flowers, many, many of the true flowers. So you have to be careful when you're talking about what is a flower. Sometimes what looks like a flower is actually many flowers.
So sometimes it's like there's window dressing, and we can talk about some of the purposes for that. That's not the, and we say flower if we're thinking of like a florist's arrangement, the flower, but it's sometimes the more subtle interior parts that are, or some of them aren't interior, but the more subtle parts that are the actual reproductive, is a flower a reproductive part? Is that
flower?
Is that
what you're right. The flower is the reproductive part of a plant.
Right.
So essentially, it has to have at least the male or the female part. In most cases, it will have both, in which case it's called a perfect flower, which doesn't mean that it's perfectly beautiful or anything like that. It has both male and female parts.
Funny. And you just mentioned skunk cabbage. Now, that is a perfect, isn't that a perfect flower? I'm trying to remember. I'm not, my botany is a little rough sometimes. Is that a perfect flower that has male and female?
Right. Each one of those little flowers that's studded on the spadix within that enclosing spate is perfect. It has both male and female parts. But
right.
They're extremely simple flowers. That's really basically all they have.
Right. It's funny because I believe its cousin, taxonomically speaking, Jack in the Pulpit or the Aracemas, even though they're related, I don't think Jack in the Pulpit, and even though it has, well, it has the name Jack, it's not a perfect flower, is it? Aren't some of them?
That's true. Yeah. They're generally either male or female flowers on its spadix. Occasionally you'll find a rare plant with that has both. I've never seen one myself. Usually the larger ones are female because they need the energy to develop fruits and seeds, and the smaller ones are male.
Right. So when people say inflorescence, it's not that it conjures a specific, precise visual. It can be very different, and there are different types of inflorescences, right? Like, I think there's like racemes and panicles and umbels. And so there's these different types of them. So it's not just one visual, right? When I say inflorescence, you don't know exactly what it's going to look like.
Right. The inflorescence just refers to the arrangement or the grouping of flowers on the flower stalk. So for instance, it may be just a spike, in which case little flowers are attached directly to the stalk, but there are several of them. People may refer to it as a flower, but it's actually several flowers along that stalk. And if each flower has a little pedicel attaching it to the stalk, then it's a raceme. So there are all sorts of terms.
Right.
To describe how the flowers are attached to the main peduncle or stalk of the inflorescence.
So you said the ones that, for instance, an example of ones that might have tiny ones right on the stalk. I mean, the mint family's like that, and I think people could get a visual of that if they know anything in the mint family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have those, do you say pedicel, the little tiny stalks that in some other of these arrangements, other types of inflorescences, each little flower is kind of on a teeny little stalk off the main stalk.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in some cases, you mentioned umbels. In that case, they are on usually longer stalks that are arranged all at one point on the main stem and come off so that the end of it reaches the same level as the one next to it, next to it, next to it, and forms a sort of flat or dome-shaped inflorescence. And if you think of Queen Anne's lace, that would be a good example of an umbel.
Right.
I always think of it as sort of an upside-down umbrella.
I love that. I love that in the book. I started to laugh because, you know, I thought, oh, of course it is. That's the architecture if I think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Now, it's kind of dizzying again, you know, racemes, panicles, corums, umbels. Oh, my goodness. But there must be method to this madness of all these words. The precision has a perfect purpose, scientifically speaking, yes? I mean,
It does, because many plants in certain families only have one particular type of inflorescence.
Right.
So they can use those to define a family by.
Right.
For instance, in the daisy family, what comprises those many, many flowers that we talked about, for instance, the yellow center of the daisy and the white surrounding petal-like structures, are all part of what's called a composite head. And the inner ones are disc flowers. They are the center of the disc. And the outer ones are ray flowers. And depending on the species that you're talking about, all of those flowers may have reproductive parts within them, or some may be sterile and maybe they're just to attract insects.
Right. And that gets to the purpose, and what we call a flower isn't necessarily the flower, where the action is. In a lot of cases, it actually is the window dressing meant to attract the needed insect interactions and so forth.
I mean, I think of all cases, that's true, either by color or fragrance in some cases. But if you look out in the woods, you see that sort of reddish haze that's out there, or in some cases it's a brownish haze. Those are flowers of the red maple trees or elm trees, and they are very simple flowers. Surprisingly, even though the red maple flowers are very small, they are often pollinated by insects because they do produce nectar and copious amounts of pollen that are collected usually by small bees. Mason bees in particular are good pollinators. They do produce nectar to attract them as well, whereas the elm flowers are strictly wind-pollinated. So they don't need to be showy at all. They just sort of dangle there in their male parts, let the wind carry the pollen away to land on the female parts of other trees.
Right, right. You know, maybe we should get a little quick tour from you of some floral parts, because some of the words, they almost sound like anagrams of each other, you know, like petal, tepal, sepal.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I don't know how those words were developed, what the etymology is, but the sepals are usually the outer whorl of a flower. If you work your way from outer to inner center of the flower, the sepals, primary job is to protect the flower while it's in bud. In most cases, there are always exceptions to all these rules. For instance, I can think of hepatica, which is just beginning to bloom now. And in that case, the sepals are petal-like. They're colored pink or purple or white, and they're the main attractant for insects. The flower does not have true sepals. It has outer fuzzy bracts that cover the buds before the flower opens. So, as I say, there are always exceptions, but in general, most flowers have sepals which cover the buds. Sometimes they fall off afterwards, as with bloodroot, they very quickly fall off. And then the next whorl of flower parts, as you're heading inward, are the petals, and their purpose is generally to attract insects. They're usually colorful. Working your way in will be the male parts, the stamens, which are comprised of filaments and the anthers bearing the pollen. And at the center is the pistil, or in many cases several pistils, which each pistil is comprised of an ovary, the structure that will develop into the fruit and contain the seeds. Topped by a pistil in many cases, not all cases, and then a stigma, which is the receptive part on which the pollen lands. Once the pollen lands on that receptive stigma, it actually begins to grow a long tube down into the ovary where the ovules are and release sperm that actually go down through that tube to fertilize the egg cells.
It's amazing.
So, really a lot more complicated than you think.
Right. And again, it's not just, oh, look at the pretty flower. There's so much complexity going on. And the co-evolutionary history that's being reflected in the way these parts are structured, colored, showcased, whether they have fragrance, whether they have dot, 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 dot. The co-evolution with the sort of partner animals, often insects, you know, it's just fascinating.
And sometimes it's very strict. Sometimes it's a one-on-one relationship, only one specific species of insect will be suitable for pollination of that flower. And the insects often use cues, some of which we can see. There are often, for instance, on spring beauty, you have the pink lines that head down toward the center, which actually helps guide the insects down to where the nectar is, at a little yellow spot at the base of each petal. But sometimes those cues are only visible to insects. They form a UV pattern that we can't see with our eyes. But if you look at it under black light or UVA light, they can be seen. And it makes almost like a brilliant bullseye that is surprising sometimes in its contrast to the rest of the flower.
Right.
Makes it easy for the insect not to waste its time searching for the nectar. but is invisible to us.
I sometimes think of it as like the various patterns on, you know, the surface of an airport, you know, the runways and so forth. It's like over here, over here, or the guys with the lights, you know, with holding the lights and shaking the lights and showing the plane where to go.
Well, that's what it's like. That's a good analogy.
Yeah. I wanted to just derail for a second and talk about sometimes there are flowers that we don't see. We've been talking about ones that maybe would be more visible if we poked around above ground. Sometimes there's ones that are hidden, like the violets have always fascinated me. And could we talk about those? Are they called cleistogamous? Is that what those are
called? Exactly, right. Violets have two kinds of flowers. They have the pretty white or purple or yellow showy flowers that we see and that insects visit. But they also produce another type of flower that never opens down at the base of the plant. Usually they're produced later in the season, and they serve as sort of a backup. Say it's a cold, rainy spring, and there aren't very many insects flying at the time that violets are in flower, so the plant is not very successful in reproducing. In that case, it can reproduce within that cleistogamous flower, that very tiny, what looks like a little tiny flower bud that never opens. It has very simple male and female reproductive structures inside. The male structure pollinates the female structure, and it actually produces seeds.
Huh.
But, of course, those seeds are not as desirable as those that would be outcrossed because you don't get the genetic diversity that you would get, just as in animal breeding or anything else. You want that diversity in the genetic makeup. But not only violets have that cleistogamous flower, but also jewelweed.
Oh.
later in the year, you'll find it's difficult to tell whether it is a little flower, but I've only been able to tell by going back day after day and looking at them, that these are cleistogamous flowers as well, and they can reproduce in that way, and they don't have the seed pods that spring out and make everybody amazed when they shoot their flowers out, their seeds out, rather.
I think there's probably a word for that, too, when seeds are shot around. There's probably a scientific word for that, too, because there's a word for everything.
Right. I just call it amazing.
Yes, indeed. So if the sort of hidden backup set of flowers, simpler flowers down there, is cleistogamous, are the ones above ground, do they have a label too, or are they called something else?
Of course they do. They're called chasmogamous.
Chasmogamous, okay.
Right.
That's the word of the day.
yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And cleistogamy really comes from the same root as cloistered. They're sort of protected and enclosed like that.
Right. That makes sense. So I wonder, in, you know, doing this A to Z, this little book, Floripedia, you know, there were some things you probably knew you were going to put in and others that you didn't and things you happened on. I'm sure you did lots of research, even though you already had a lot of knowledge. And maybe one topical one, it's almost the time for them, is tulips. There were a couple of entries related to tulips, and I wonder if you want to give us a little ha-ha tiptoe through the tulips.
Well, tulips should be blooming in our part of the world fairly soon. Actually have some species tulips growing here, but they're not quite in bloom yet. They bloom a little earlier than the others. But tulips are a plant that's, the tulip itself is native primarily to Central Asia and to the Balkan region. And they have been favored once they were brought westward as prime examples of the beauty of a flower. They are one of those flowers you mentioned, tepals, sometime earlier in this talk, that are comprised of six tepals, which is really just a technical term for the outer world of three sepals and the inner world of three petals, which look almost identical. So it's used in Most members of the lily family, lilies themselves, daylilies, tulips. So they have six tepals. The reproductive parts are easy to see in tulips.
Yes.
And they are incredibly beautiful. The tulips have been developed by humans from 75 wild species to now about 6,000 registered cultivars.
Wow.
So there's a great demand for tulips, and this demand was at its peak back in the early 1600s during a time that's now referred to as tulipomania. It was probably the first big financial bubble. And at that point, tulips could sell, one particular bulb could sell for maybe somebody's entire estate or property would be exchanged for that one bulb. That's how important they were as status symbols and as prime garden plants. And those that were favored, strangely enough, were those that suffered from a virus, which was not known at that point, but they were the ones that developed these maybe red and white or purple and white streaked petals. They're called broken tulips because the pattern is broken like that.
Yeah.
And they are often portrayed by the Dutch still life painters.
Right.
You see them in many of those old paintings. But it was found that streaking is caused by a mosaic virus, which in fact is detrimental to the plants overall. Eventually they will spread that virus to other plants, and the plants will weaken because of it and eventually die out.
Right. Right. Well, in the last minute or two or three, was there another one that kind of was a little bit of a discovery for you, or something fun that you remember, in doing the kind of homework that led to this book? Any other fun
ones?
Well,
what was fun was that Princeton gave me free range as long as it was connected somehow with flowers.
Yeah.
And so it allowed me to look into historical topics and topics having to do with art and artists who painted or drew flowers. For instance, the artists who traveled with the early plant explorers were extremely important because they had no way to take photographs of these things in flower. And often by the time they got what they tried to take back as living specimens back, they were no longer looking as though they were going to survive. Most did not survive, so they just had the pressed specimens. So those botanical artists were extremely important on the early expeditions. And today, most of that's been replaced by photography.
Right.
But with photography, you can't always show every part of a flower the way a botanical artist can, where he or she may take it apart and draw each separate part. So many scientists still like to take a botanical artist with them sometimes. Although these artists are very skilled at working from dried plant specimens and even taking the dried flowers or pickled flowers and boiling them up to get the three-dimensional structure and being able to draw the flower from that.
Huh. So you got to include some of those as entries in your A to Z in Florapedia.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Carol, it's always good to talk to you, and I look forward to someday before long going on another walk together and actually looking at flowers together in real life.
Right. Yes. I hope before too long.
Yes. So thank you. Thanks for making time today, and I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks. It's always fun to talk with you, Margaret.
Bye-bye.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
Thanks to all the rest of you for listening too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.